From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Throughout her tenure, she has been a discerning and conscientious judge and a public servant of complete integrity. Justice O'Connor's great intellect, wisdom, and personal decency have won her the esteem of her colleagues and our country.
Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor retires, setting the stage for a major political battle in Washington.
I can't emphasize enough how huge the stakes are with this Supreme Court vacancy.
Nan Aaron of the Alliance for Justice will be debating the Conservative Committee for Justice. We'll also be joined by the head of Planned Parenthood. Then leaders of the world's wealthiest nations gathering in Scotland this week for the Group of Eight summit as police round up protesters in the streets. Nelson Mandela calls on the G8 to make poverty its highest priority.
Overcoming poverty is not a gesture of charity. It is an act of justice. It is the protection of a fundamental human right, the right to dignity and decent life. While poverty persists, there is no true freedom.
And imprisoned Native American leader Leonard Peltier is no longer at Leavenworth. After more than a decade, he's been transferred to Terre Haute, Indiana, and put in solitary confinement. We'll speak with his attorney. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. For the first time in 11 years, there's a vacancy on the Supreme Court. On Friday, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor announced her resignation. In 1981, she became the first woman to serve on the country's highest court. President Bush could announce a nominee as early as next week. A battle has already begun in Washington over O'Connor's replacement, both between liberal and conservative groups, as well as within the conservative movement. The Washington Post reports political groups could spend as much as $100 million in the lead-up to the Senate confirmation vote. On the divided court, O'Connor often cast the deciding decision. She voted to uphold the landmark abortion decision Roe v. Wade, also ruled to overturn sodomy laws, uphold affirmative action, and against the death penalty in many instances. In 2000, she ruled in Bush v. Gore to stop all presidential recounts, thus giving President Bush the White House. For President Bush, this might become the first of three seats he fills over the next 3 years. It had been widely speculated that Chief Justice William Rehnquist would retire this year. It's also considered likely the court's oldest member, the 85-year-old John Paul Stevens, will retire before Bush's term ends. We'll have more on the future of the Supreme Court in a few minutes. In Iraq, Egypt's top diplomat in Baghdad is still missing after being kidnapped by gunmen Saturday. Ihab al-Sharif became the first head of a foreign mission to be captured since the war began. He was poised to become the first Arab ambassador to the new Iraqi government. Meanwhile, the top diplomat at Bahrain's embassy was wounded earlier today when gunmen shot him in the shoulder in Baghdad. On Saturday, U.S. troops opened fire on two cars carrying civilians west of the capital. A woman and her child were killed. The woman's father-in-law is seriously wounded. The Christian family was driving to Jordan. Meanwhile, Iraq's ambassador to the United Nations, Samir Soumaideh, is accusing U.S. Marines of shooting dead his 21-year-old nephew. According to the ambassador, his nephew was arrested because Marines found a rifle at his home. After Marines detained him, the young man was found dead with a bullet in his neck. The Iraqi government has admitted its security forces are carrying out torture and abusing detainees. The admission came after a report in the Observer of London revealed the existence of secret torture chambers and murder campaigns carried out by government-backed paramilitary groups. A government spokesperson blamed it in part on the brutalizing of Iraqi society under Saddam Hussein. The spokesman said, quote, "These things happen. We know that." And on Saturday, the Iraqi resistance killed 26 people and injured 50 others in a series of attacks. The killings came exactly 2 years after Bush urged insurgents to bring on more attacks. On July 2, 2003, Bush said, quote, "There are some who feel like that the conditions are such that they can attack us there. My answer is bring them on. We've got the force necessary to deal with the security situation," Bush said. President Bush is flying to Europe today to take part in the Group of Eight summit in Scotland. While the summit opens on Wednesday, Scotland's already been the scene of mass protest. On Saturday, more than 200,000 demonstrators gathered in Edinburgh for the Make Poverty History March. That same day, simultaneous concerts were held in 10 cities around the world in an attempt to increase the world's attention about poverty in Africa. Back in Scotland on Monday, some 2,000 anti-war protesters blockaded Scotland's largest military base, the Royal Navy submarine base at Faslane. The base is home port for all four British Trident nuclear-armed submarines. So far, police in Edinburgh have arrested up to 100 protesters in demonstrations leading up to the G8 meetings. More protests are scheduled throughout the week. In Afghanistan, the Boston Globe's reporting that 2005 has become the deadliest year so far in Afghanistan for U.S. troops since the invasion nearly 4 years ago. At least 54 U.S. troops died in the first half of the year. That's more than the total number killed all of last year. Over the weekend, U.S. forces found the bodies of two Navy SEALs who were killed near the site where a U.S. military helicopter was down last week, killing all 16 aboard. Meanwhile, Afghan officials have said a U.S. airstrike has killed 17 villagers, including women and children. The U.S. confirmed civilians had died but maintained the target was a known Taliban compound. President Hamid Karzai condemned the attack. His chief of staff said, quote, "There's no way the killing of civilians can be justified. It's the terrorists we're fighting. It's not our people who should suffer." In Washington, speculation's growing that President Bush's chief advisor, Karl Rove, may have played a role in the outing of the CIA operative Valerie Plame. Rove's attorney, Robert Luskin, has admitted Rove personally spoke with Matthew Cooper from Time magazine about Plame, but Luskin insists Rove didn't disclose her identity. Disclosing an undercover agent is a federal crime. Cooper, along with Judith Miller from The New York Times, are both facing up to 4 months in jail for refusing to disclose their sources about the story. However, Cooper's employer, Time magazine, last week agreed to hand over a copy of Cooper's notes. In those notes, it's reportedly revealed that Cooper spoke with Rove. On Sunday, New York Senator Charles Schumer called on Rove to personally deny leaking the name of a CIA official. Up until now, the Bush administration has claimed Rove had no role in the case. On October 10, 2003, White House spokesperson Scott McClellan said Rove was, quote, not involved in this. In Israel, the country's president warned Monday that right-wing Israeli extremists might try to assassinate Prime Minister Ariel Sharon. Sharon's been the target of many death threats in recent months by opponents of the planned evacuation of the Jewish settlers from the Gaza Strip. Agence France-Presse is reporting all Israeli cabinet ministers are now being fitted with flak jackets, which they will wear during public appearances. And former Democratic Senator Gaylord Nelson has died at the age of 89. Nelson also served as governor of Wisconsin. He helped found Earth Day in 1970 and was known for being one of the architects of the country's modern environmental movement. Nelson helped pass the Clean Air and Water Acts, preserve the Appalachian Trail, establish fuel efficiency standards, and ban the insecticide DDT. President Clinton awarded Nelson the Presidential Medal of Freedom in 1995. Nelson was also a leading opponent of the Vietnam War. He was one of the only senators, one of three, who voted against the $700 million appropriation that began the nation's expanded involvement in Vietnam. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor retired from the bench last Friday and set in motion a high-stakes political battle that could last for months. O'Connor was considered a crucial swing vote or a, quote, moderate conservative. Whoever is appointed to replace her could dramatically shift the court further to the right, especially when it comes to issues like abortion, affirmative action, and civil liberties. In 1981, O'Connor became the first woman appointed to the Supreme Court. She's been described as the most powerful woman in America and has resigned at the age of 75. She was appointed by President Ronald Reagan, expected to toe the conservative line. She disappointed conservatives in the 1989 case, Webster v. Reproductive Health Services. O'Connor was the deciding vote that upheld a law giving states the right to make specific abortion decisions, defying the conservative push for further restrictions on abortion. The right to legal abortion is supported by six of the current justices, so it appears secure in the short term. With O'Connor's departure, it'll probably take the resignation of only one of the court's four remaining moderate to liberal members to overturn Roe v. Wade, the landmark 1973 decision that made abortion legal. O'Connor's resignation came as a surprise when attention had focused on the possible upcoming resignation of the Chief Justice, William Rehnquist. He's 80 years old, suffering from thyroid cancer. Rehnquist is expected to resign before President Bush leaves office. After President Bush makes his selection, there will be confirmation hearings, the first in almost 11 years. Bush stated on Friday he wants a dignified confirmation process. Here he is speaking in Washington.
The nation deserves, and I will select, a Supreme Court justice that Americans can be proud of. The nation also deserves a dignified process of confirmation in the United States Senate, characterized by fair treatment, a fair hearing, and a fair vote.
That was President Bush speaking in Washington last Friday. But even though the nomination of a new Supreme Court justice is at least a week away, the battle lines are already vividly drawn. Conservative groups are pressing for Bush to make good on his campaign promise of appointing someone in the mold of Clarence Thomas and Antonin Scalia, two of the most conservative members of the court. They've also vociferously opposed the selection of the frequently mentioned White House Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez because they question his commitment to overturn abortion rights. Democrats are asking for an appointment in the mold of the more centrist O'Connor. This is a notable contrast from what many Democrats felt about her in December of 2000 when she voted with the majority to end the Florida recount and give the presidency to Bush. We're joined today by three guests who are with organizations deeply involved in the process. In our studio here in New York, Nan Aaron joins us. She's president of the Alliance for Justice. We're joined on the telephone by Sean Rushton. He is executive director of the Committee for Justice, one of the leading conservative groups based out of Washington. And Karen Pearl joins us. She's interim president of Planned Parenthood. In 1985, Nan Aaron founded the Alliance's judicial selection process, which since its inception has been a major player in the judicial nominations process. This is Democracy Now! Welcome all to Democracy Now! Nan Aaron, first, were you very surprised?
We were very surprised. We didn't expect Sandra Day O'Connor to resign. Of course, all eyes were on the Chief Justice. On the other hand, we had heard for several years that she was thinking about leaving the court, and it was assumed that when and if Bush made it to a second term, that she would take leave at that point.
And your plans now?
Well, all eyes are now on the White House. We are looking to President Bush to make a really historic decision. We're hoping that he picks someone in the mold of a Sandra Day O'Connor, a moderate, consensus, and most importantly, independent justice for the Supreme Court. You know, when she was chosen in 1980, lawyers urged President Reagan, the most conservative president up until then, to choose her over the objections of radical right groups in this country. He made that choice, and she has served with distinction on the Supreme Court.
Sean Rushton, your response to it being Sandra Day O'Connor and not William Rehnquist, who announced retirement on Friday.
I think we were surprised as well. As Nan says, it was expected it would be the Chief Justice. I'm not sure beyond that initial surprise, though, what it really changes. You know, as you said at the beginning, the president campaigned twice and also grew his majority in the Senate on the promise that he would appoint a court that would be less activist, that would involve itself less in decision-making that should really be left to the political branches of government. He cited Scalia and Thomas in that mold, and I think groups like Nan's said before the election that if Bush were to be reelected, that it would be a sign or that it would be an opportunity for him to remake the court per his promises. And I think now that he's been reelected grown his majorities in the Senate, it's a good opportunity for him to keep that promise.
Your plans?
Our plans? Well, we're going to work to make sure that the positive side of the story gets told. We know that our opponents on the other side are very skillful at putting out negative information and often distorting the records of conservative nominees. We're going to make sure that the positive story gets out there.
Well, what President Bush could do is what Sean says he might do, which is to pick a nominee in the mold of Scalia and Thomas, or to pick a nominee similar to his Court of Appeals judges, like Janice Rogers Brown, Priscilla Owen, William Pryor. But what he should do is to realize the very momentous decision he has to make, to realize that he governs a country that is extremely big, that is filled with people of divergent viewpoints, races, religions, and rise to the occasion. Pick a nominee who can represent everyone in this country and not simply one fringe part of the Republican Party. We're calling on him to name someone who respects individual rights, who appreciates the progress America has made, someone who can make decisions that protect all Americans and not side with special big business interests.
We're also joined by interim president of Planned Parenthood Federation of America, Karen Pearl. PPFA, Planned Parenthood, has a case before the next Supreme Court, the next session. Your response to the stepping down of Sandra Day O'Connor, and can you describe what's at stake with your next case?
Sure. We are, of course, very concerned that the justice that did step down was Sandra Day O'Connor, because she was the critical swing vote. She was the justice who really held in her decisions the constitutional protection for women's reproductive health. And so right now we see reproductive rights, women's health and safety, to be extremely in danger. And because we do have this case before the Supreme Court, AOC versus Planned Parenthood, we particularly are focused on the requirement, if you will, that the president choose somebody who is very much in the mold of Sandra Day O'Connor, who understands the importance, the primacy of keeping women's health and safety, and who will continue to uphold the fact that women ought to be healthy and ought to have medical procedures that are safe for them.
I would just want to add, I think Karen Pearl set out this issue just right. In addition to abortion rights, which are clearly critical issue in the upcoming hearings, there are also other issues at stake as well, and I want to make sure that we focus on those as well as what Karen Pearl has just described: workers' rights, consumer protections, environmental protections, civil rights, women's rights. You know, the next court is going to make decisions that affect every aspect of our life, every aspect. Choice, whether or not we have privacy in our homes, whether or not we have safe workplaces, whether the water we drink is clean. So in addition to choice, we need to make sure that the administration, and in particular the nominee, is forthcoming on his or her views on a whole range of issues, including Roe versus Wade.
What do you think, Sean Rushton, Executive Director of Committee for Justice, is the most critical issue that your organization, your constituency, feels most strongly about?
I think broadly, the idea, if you're just listening to the rhetoric of the two ladies, I think it's clear that it's a difference of vision, really, between a court that is limited and it really is a judicial body as opposed to a political and cultural body. And I think, you know, what their view is that it should be this kind of great platonic guardianship that makes all sorts of decisions in American life. I think what the conservative view of the law is, which is, by the way, I would say not so much a political category as much as a sort of one of jurisprudential philosophy, is that the court really should be confined to absolutely defending, you know, the rights that are in the Constitution. For example, I would cite property rights. That's something that's in the Constitution. We've just seen it eviscerated by the primarily by the liberal wing of the court. I would say, anyway, to answer your question, I think the answer is limiting the power of the court back to something that comports, I think, better with our constitutional system. That's the big issue overarching everything else.
We're going to continue our discussion about the replacement for Sandra Day O'Connor and the nation's highest court when we come back from our break. Our guests are Sean Rushton, Executive Director of Committee for Justice, Nan Aaron, President of Alliance for Justice, and Karen Pearl, the Interim President of Planned Parenthood Federation of America. We're also going to find out how exactly the groups are mobilizing, what's happening at a grassroots level. Stay with us. Mantras dizem que aconselho O tuluona está mestre pega atrás de céu Mantras dizem que aconselho Que não se te engana nos Lua e de nós Lua e pa nós Que manguina contra cubicilão Gameste machil E sam certo cumai na fio Luto de ronda de marca Chica cuspina mão Bunda moja na som O maja suco Quando gata no Yake yake chibirgue Do sopele como que assim Lua nho como Quando gata no muyaga yaga chibirge, tu sopele como yasik, lua nyo como. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We broadcast on more than 350 stations around the country, on Pacifica and NPR stations, on low-power FM and public access TV stations, PBS stations, as well as both TV satellite networks, on Dish Network's channel 9415, Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and also on DirecTV channel 375. We video and audio stream at democracynow.org, and we are also closed caption for people who are deaf and hard of hearing. Our headlines are also translated into Spanish and transcript as well as on audio at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman as we continue our discussion. After O'Connor, Sandra Day O'Connor has resigned from the bench, says she will stay until a replacement is found. Our guests are Nan Aaron. Nan Aaron is head of the Alliance for Justice. Sean Rushton is with us, Executive Director of the Committee for Justice, and Karen Pearl, Interim President of Planned Parenthood Federation of America, which has a case before the next Supreme Court. How you're organizing? Let's begin with Karen Pearl. On Friday, nonstop conference calls, meetings, all through the weekend, this July 4th weekend. What are your plans at a grassroots level?
We are very excited about our plans. We obviously have been preparing for a long time for justice to step down, whether it was going to be the Chief Justice or, as it became, Justice O'Connor. And so we have a plan in place for every stage of this process that relies on all of the work that we have done over these past few years in all 50 states to get our activists on board and mobilize. And so we have strategies for being literally in the communities, doing rallies, for activists to be using the internet to communicate with their senators. We have days of action plan throughout the summer and into the fall. We have people who are checking the media in their local markets so that they can correct misinformation through letters to the editor or to op-eds. So we've got a number of strategies that involve people in our communities, our patients, our grassroots activists, and our large number of people who hold very influential positions in the community, all ready to go to do a number of different actions as this process goes on. We have already contacted over 1 million of our supporters. We have campus, 170 campus chapters of students who are activists, and we have letters coming in, emails coming in. So everybody is in touch with the White House and with the Senate, and we believe that the voice for a moderate, thoughtful, deliberative, open-minded jurist, that message will come out loud and clear from Planned Parenthood supporters.
Sean Rushton, Executive Director of Committee for Justice. First, can you explain what your group is, the umbrella of conservative groups, starting with what, something like $18 million, and the discussion of how much money is going to be poured in overall, perhaps over $100 million. Tell us about when the Committee for Justice was established.
We were created 3 years ago in response to the treatment of one of the president's appellate court nominees, Charles Pickering, who was disgracefully linked to defending the Ku Klux Klan and called sympathetic to racists and all the rest. So the feeling on the right was there wasn't a group that existed sort of full time to counter the many groups that exist on the left to fight our nominees. So we were created at that point. And we will do, I imagine, much of what was just described on the other side. We're not a grassroots group as such, so we will be sort of working with and helping those groups, whether they be anti-tax groups or anti-big government groups or business groups or social conservative groups, to put together their messages and to expand their grassroots networks out. And to make clear why all these diverse segments of the center-right coalition are affected by this issue, and whether your issue is school choice or government regulation or social issues, that this is really a big fight, and the other side sees it as for what it is, which is no holds barred kind of exercise.
And
so we need to be ready.
Who funds Committee for Justice?
Our funding is, well, it's private individuals, and it's some members of the business community.
Uh-huh. Like?
Well, like, I'm not going to list my donors by name. If Nan will list hers, I'll list mine.
Nan Aaron, who funds the Alliance for Justice?
Oh, we have funding from individuals, foundations. You know, it's no surprise that business groups are dumping so much money into this campaign. They're hoping that these courts around the country, as well as the Supreme Court, become business-friendly courts. Our unprecedented effort on the progressive side contains more than 70 organizations representing millions of Americans, labor, environment, civil rights, consumer groups, environmental organizations. I think we, while they may have the money, we certainly have the advantage of representing so many people around the country that are going to weigh in on this momentous decision.
How are you going to organize?
Well, already these organizations are hiring organizers, doing communications work, getting messages out over the internet, getting hold of individuals who can talk to senators. The most important people in this effort will be those 100 senators. And we on the progressive side cannot just assume, because President Bush won the election, that we turn to electoral politics in 2 years. We have got to engage now in this effort to make sure that our judges are fair and independent. And so we all need to be working, calling our people, putting people on our list,
now,
getting involved.
President Bush may be at an all-time low for support, but it may go lower. So he has his chance now to put in the most conservative person possible.
Well, he certainly, again, could do what I think Sean Rushton expects him to do, which is to put a nominee on the court who has a very clear, distinct political agenda. I think that would be shameful, and I don't think it would be in the best interest of America, and we're calling on him to put someone up who represents all of America, not just Sean Rushton's groups.
Karen Pearl, interim president of Planned Parenthood Federation of America, one of the people who's been mentioned as a possible candidate for Supreme Court justice, is Alberto Gonzalez, who made a surprise trip to Iraq this weekend, attorney general of the United States. While his name has been very much in the news because what many people say is laying the legal groundwork for the torture by saying the Geneva Conventions don't apply. When there are objections raised to him right now, interestingly, from conservatives, it's that his position on abortion may not be tough enough. What is your understanding of Alberto Gonzalez's position on abortion?
We're not really prepared at this moment to talk about any particular nominee. What we are willing to say is that we will not accept any extremist or right-wing ideologue as a nominee. We must make sure that whoever is put forward by President Bush is somebody who will protect women's health and safety. And so we will go through a careful process before we make any comment about specific nominees to vet where they stand on protecting women's health and women's safety. And, you know, you mentioned earlier that President Bush is at an all-time low. This is a real opportunity for President Bush to really stand with the American public who really want to preserve individual rights and individual liberties and to pick a justice who will do that as opposed to a justice who will take an extremist position. And so we are also, as Nan Aaron said, really asking the president to hold to his promise of finding a justice that all Americans can be proud of, somebody who will protect the individual liberties that we have come to value as the very fabric of the American life.
On that issue of Alberto Gonzalez, Sean Rushton, your response.
Well, my organization will support General Gonzalez if he is the president's choice. It's as simple as that.
What do you think of him before he is named as the president's choice?
I think he's a good man. We think he would be a fine addition to the court.
Well, I'm sorry that Sean has said that. I think there's a lot about Alberto Gonzalez that we don't know, and the American people have a right to know. He was one of the chief architects of our policies on torture in the United States. I don't know that we really have a full understanding of his views on civil rights, women's rights, the right to choose. Our poll released last week shows American people want the Senate to conduct a broad, independent inquiry. And it will be up to Gonzalez, if he's the nominee, and the administration to be forthcoming on these issues as well as many others.
Can you talk about some of the other choices? Sean Rushton, for example, Judge Roberts. Can you talk about who he is, John Roberts, one of the names that has been put forward, also a friend of President Bush?
Well, he's a judge on the D.C. Circuit. He is regarded as a solid thinker, someone of a likable disposition, and a good constitutionalist. So I think he has a very good chance of being in the top tier of.
What does a good constitutionalist mean?
Well, it goes back to what I said at the beginning. It's really the distinction between, I think, the other side's view, which is that the court should act more as a political and cultural arbiter, handing down decisions that don't necessarily directly relate to the text of the Constitution, versus the more conservative view, which is that the legislative process is where most new law should be made, and that the courts really should be in the business of protecting the Constitution as it stands and as it's written.
Nan Aaron, Judge Roberts.
Well, Judge Roberts, there's much that we don't know about Judge Roberts. And again, getting back to my earlier point, it's important that the American people, and particularly the Senate, come to understand what John Roberts thinks and where he stands on the issues of the day. I will say this, though. I do believe for any nominee, if that individual is hostile to individual rights, protections, and freedoms in this country, we will call on the Senate to defeat that nominee. However, before we even get there, it is incumbent on the Senate to let the American people know who these nominees are and allow for the broadest possible hearing, scrutinizing aspects of the nominee's record. It is incredibly important given that this person will help shape the future of our country and our judiciary for decades to come.
What about the issue of the questioning? The New York Times raised this. For example, Arlen Specter, well-known during the Bork confirmation process, questioning him for something like an hour and a half. What do you think should be the form of this hearing, and what is acceptable? And how can you put pressure on senators to actually raise the issues you care about? The Democrats have not stood up very much. I mean, if you look at the examples of the invasion of Iraq, et cetera, the word standing up would not be one that would be first in thinking of.
Well, you know, this is the most important domestic decision that President Bush will have made so far in his presidency. Poll after poll shows that the American people do not want the Senate to be a rubber stamp, that they want the senators to be able to understand who the nominee is and where he or she stands on many different issues. Therefore, it will be incumbent upon the Senate, and we are counting on Senator Specter, chairman of the Judiciary Committee, to conduct a fair and thorough hearing so that these issues of temperament, judicial philosophy, constitutional philosophy can be fully explored. After all, this person will sit on this court not just for the next 2 or 3 years, but perhaps decades to come. And we all as Americans have a right to know what this person thinks and what this person will do once confirmed to the court.
Sharon Rushton, what senators can you absolutely trust? Do you absolutely think you have in your court? And who needs to be worked on?
That's a long list, I think. Let me mention a few senators in particular. I think the senators that we're most interested in, aside from most of the Republicans, I believe we are starting from the assumption that we have pretty much all the Republicans likely to support the president's nominee. But we're also interested in, and this goes back to the issue of consultation as well, of reaching out to more moderate Democrats, not the liberal wing of the Senate Democrats, but people like Ben Nelson from Nebraska, Mark Pryor of Arkansas, maybe Joe Lieberman, Bill Nelson of Florida. Those are Democrats that I think will be more reasonable on this issue, who are not pushed by the by the liberal interest groups to hatch a job for the nominee. And there are about 10 Senate Democrats at least who I think are very open to reasonable debate.
And this issue of the filibuster, was this a compromise or agreeing not to filibuster, or did the Democrats lose out entirely? What actually will happen? I mean, obviously the Democrats are in the minority in the Senate.
Well, we certainly believe, and many of the signatories to that deal have said that the filibuster lives and will be able to be applied in any forthcoming Supreme Court nominations. Certainly, though, if President Bush names an individual who would shift the ideological balance on the court to the right, placing in jeopardy individual rights and freedoms, we would fully expect there to be a fight. Maybe we don't even need the filibuster. You know, I've been talking about the role of the president and his momentous decision. This is also a decision that's going to be made by 100 senators. And during Court of Appeals debates in this country, most people tend not to focus on the merits of a debate on a Court of Appeals nominee. Supreme Court is different. The nation's attention will be focused on who the nominee is and the very important seat for which that person is being nominated. American people will look at this, will study, will watch these hearings on TV. This will not be an easy vote cast by a senator. And we're also looking to these senators to think of this vote as perhaps the most important vote they will take as well. Some of them are up next year, and their constituents will be looking very closely at what they say and what they do.
Well, I want to thank you all for being with us. Nan Aaron, President of Alliance for Justice, Karen Pearl, Interim President of Planned Parenthood Federation of America, and Sean Rushton, Executive Director of the Committee for Justice. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we go to the G8 in Edinburgh. Stay with us.
Muhammad Wate, Nyen Fu ki adia mamli mamu wote mahdiulai Muhammad wa khona madin tioni sidina limamo fenchete fesco ana kisa Mami mamran lai moni wongeke yo hanga maika pekenanga delu chalake gedelo lai kerok lo wote hati budai lai Kailen kalailen, nyolen dikure, jamulamul azam lai. Modeluse.
The music by Senegalese singer Youssou N'Dour, one of the few African artists who had a prominent role in Saturday's Live 8 concerts that were held around the world. In the wake of the concerts calling on the world's richest countries to make poverty history, the Group of Eight Nations begins its three-day summit Wednesday in Gleneagles, Scotland. African poverty and global climate change are at the top of the agenda, yet it's unclear how much action will come out of the meetings. France, Russia, and major environmental groups are calling for British Prime Minister and G8 Chair Tony Blair to draw up a binding agreement on climate change that would set emissions targets. But President Bush says the United States will reject any plan that operates on the Kyoto Protocol model in requiring rich countries to limit fossil fuel emissions. Bush also said in an interview aired yesterday on ITV he's not going into the meetings with any sense of obligation to Tony Blair.
Tony Blair made decisions on what he thought was best for the people of Great Britain. And I made decisions on what I thought was best for Americans. And I really don't view our relationship as one of, you know, quid pro quos. I view our relationship as one of strong allies and friends working together for the common good.
President Bush. Well, the Gleneagles Summit follows a series of highly publicized free concerts in the G8 countries, as well as South Africa, that called for action to address poverty in Africa. The Live 8 concerts, organized by rock musicians Bob Geldof and Bono, reached an audience of 3 billion people via television and webcasts. The Make Poverty History Coalition is calling on the G8 to double aid to Africa, fully cancel external debt, and deliver trade justice. Former South African President Nelson Mandela spoke at the Johannesburg Live 8 concert on Sunday.
In a few days' time, the leaders of the G8 nations will meet in Scotland. They will face perhaps the most critical question that our world has had to face. How do we remove the face of poverty from our world? So much of our common future will depend on the actions and plans of these leaders. They have a historical opportunity to open the door to hope and the possibility of a better future for all. History and the generations to come will judge our leaders by the decisions they make in the coming weeks.
That was former South African President Nelson Mandela at the Live 8 concert in South Africa. We're joined by John Chahemin, chief Reuters correspondent for Southern Africa, who flew in last night from the Live 8 concert in South Africa. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy. Good to be here.
What was it like?
Fantastic. And of course, as you mentioned, and as your clip showed, the appearance of Mandela was the icing on the cake. He's very frail now, and he did make the point that he retired earlier this year. And he cannot retire in peace when there is all this poverty around. So he's been coming out for all sorts of good causes, including this one. He walked in, and the atmosphere was electric. And he went on to speak about his own views about poverty. And he made one important statement, which is that ending poverty is not a question of charity. It is an issue of justice. And he went on to even warn that not doing anything about it would amount to genocide against humanity. And these are views Mandela has held very strongly over time.
You've been covering these trade issues, and you're the chief Reuters correspondent in Southern Africa. What is the response of these countries? What role are they playing in this G8 summit?
Are you talking about the African countries?
Yes.
Yes. I think the key countries that have played a key role over the past 5 years are South Africa, Nigeria, Algeria, and Senegal. The leaders of these four countries were the spearhead of a new program in Africa now that is part of the whole plan to roll back poverty. It's called the New Partnership for Africa's Development. The idea is that African government will improve their own housekeeping, that is, embrace democracy, embrace human rights, embrace good governance. In return for that, they would expect aid, trade, and debt relief from the rich countries. And because of their spearhead role in this, they have attended the last, four or so G8 summits. And this has been part of the pressure they've been putting on these rich nations through bilateral negotiations and through a common front at the G8 as well.
We're also joined on the phone by David Miller, professor of sociology at University of Strathclyde in Glasgow. He is the co-editor of the book Arguments Against G8. There were a number of arrests this weekend at the lead-up protests against the G8. Can you describe the scene on the ground there, David Miller?
Well, I'm currently speaking to you from the center of Edinburgh, where protests were going on yesterday. This morning, only an hour ago, court cases were held against the protesters who were arrested. What happened yesterday was that there were a small number of autonomous protesters, some dressed up as clowns, who described themselves as the clandestine insurgent rebel clown army. I'm not making that up. And they were been doing impromptu demonstrations in the centre of Edinburgh, and they were, as soon as they appeared, surrounded by overwhelming police presence, intimidatory police presence, riot police, police on horseback, three van loads of dogs, and as a result of this, this has led to all sorts of trouble. The police are saying that there was violence from the protesters. There's been very little evidence of violence from the protesters. The best that the chief constable could come up with was that staves, rocks, and other material was thrown at them. Well, as far as we can tell from the press, the television footage, the other material includes some bedding plants, which were torn up from a local park when the protesters were corralled into to Princes Street Gardens in the centre of Edinburgh. So there's a real worry here that the over-the-top and intimidatory police presence is about trying to stop people from protesting, try to scare people off from protesting. We had on Saturday the biggest demonstration in Scottish history in Edinburgh, 250,000 people marching against the G8 leaders for the end of poverty. And it's clear that they are scared by the number of people on the streets, and they want to intimidate us from doing any further demonstrations. Tomorrow, there will be the most significant demonstration of the week, which will be the demonstration to the gates of Gleneagles Hotel. For those of your listeners who don't know, Gleneagles isn't actually a place. It's simply a resort for the rich, a golf club, a shooting range, archery, falconry, etc. It's a five-star hotel, and they are starting off the summit tomorrow with a sumptuous banquet. So we've got a quite worrying situation actually on the ground in Edinburgh at the moment, which is that the police have been attacking demonstrators, and we're worried that will happen tomorrow at the demonstration at Gleneagles, which is planned as a mass peaceful demonstration supported by a wide range of trade unions and others.
John Chairman, the cancellation of the debt for a number of countries that the G8 announced in advance of the summit, how significant was that?
Well, it's a start. And I think the countries they were that were affected and all the campaigners for debt cancellation, debt relief, saw this as a start. It's not the end. There were 18 countries that were on that list, or 16 of them, most of them in Africa. But there were a number of other significant countries in Africa that were left over that felt they were indeed a victim of their own success. Countries like Kenya, which because they're not doing that badly economically, they did not get on this list this time. But you also know that following on that, the Paris Club has also announced a significant debt deal with Nigeria, which would amount to something like $20 billion.
And explain the Paris Club.
The Paris Club is the government-to-government lenders. A lot of countries owe their debts to multilateral lenders like the World Bank, the African Development Bank. The 18 that were given some debt relief were, in fact, those who owed the multilateral lenders as opposed to the Paris Club, which is government lenders.
Professor David Miller, the major arguments in the streets right now are demands of the eight men in a room, the G8, that will be meeting at the resort.
Well, I think, I mean, I had to disagree with a previous comment, really. I mean, there's been in Edinburgh this morning the launch of an alternative commission for Africa report featuring a wide range of African activists, Trevor Ngwane from the Soweto Anti-Privatization Campaign, Samir Amin, the world-famous economist has been here, Charity Musumba from Jubilee South, and a wide range of other African campaigners here to say that, on the contrary, that NEPAD and the Tony Blair's Commission for Africa does not and will not help Africa, and actually that there's a problem with the debt relief which has been given. The debt campaigners have been here this morning as well, and they have been complaining not that it's only a start and it's not enough, but actually there's a problem with the debt relief which has been given, which is that it's been given only to the HIPC countries, highly indebted poor countries, and that it's been given universally with gross strings attached. That is, that there is small amounts of debt relief which are given to African countries which sign up for liberalisation of their markets, for privatisation of the public services, for privatisation of health, education, water services, and that this is really the advancement of the IMF and the World Bank agenda to extort the resources from Africa, allow multinational corporations in to steal those resources, and to force African countries to privatise their healthcare systems and other public services. So this is an agenda which is a neoliberal agenda. The countries which were mentioned as being the good children of the neoliberal agenda, it's certainly the case that South Africa, Nigeria, Algeria and Senegal have been to the forefront of the neoliberal agenda, but they are not supported by their people, and there's a real democratic deficit there. When Blair and Bush talk about good governance and allowing debt relief for good governance, what they mean is not what you and I might mean by good governance, which we would all approve. What they mean is good governance for the multinationals. They mean privatisation, liberalisation, and the further creating, the further exacerbating of the problems of inequality in Africa. So there are activists and campaigners here who fundamentally reject the position of the G8 leaders and are concerned that any deals that they do reach will simply harm Africa further.
Sociology professor David Miller speaking to us from Glasgow. John Chairman is in the studio with us, chief Reuters correspondent from Southern Africa.
Well, Amy, just to make a very quick comment on what Professor Miller said, I think it brings to the point we've been making, and I've talked to a broad range of people in Africa in the lead up to the Life 8 and the G8. And I think what is coming out is that debt relief aid alone is not an ideal package for Africa. There's a lot happening in Africa today. And I think the focus of the world should not just be on the negatives, like the crippling debt, like the conflict, like the disease. There are some good stories coming out of Africa that are not being told. Africa is making a remarkable progress on the front of business and is becoming a big investment destination. And this is where the effort of many African leaders now are turning. They don't want to rely just on trade, on aid. They want countries that are rich the companies to come and invest. If you talk to an ordinary person on the streets of Senegal, of Nigeria, what they tell you is that we want these companies to come and invest in our countries so that our young people stay in Africa, don't go to the Europe or America to look for jobs. And there has been a significant improvement in investment in telecommunications throughout Africa. 15 million telephone lines in Africa in 2000. Today, there are about 65 million. Nigeria alone is moving from less than a million telephone lines in 2000 to 20 million lines at the end of this year, and they're targeting to double that. And this is coming from investment that is making a difference to the lives of the people. And this is the story that we are increasingly at Reuters telling the world, and which a lot of African countries would like told.
Professor Miller.
Well, I mean, I really feel that Reuters shouldn't be telling this story. I mean, this indicates Reuters playing an appalling propaganda role for the West. I mean, what you're talking about here is investment opportunities for Western transnationals to come into Africa, to exploit the resources, to privatize the services, and to take the money back. The campaigners who have been here, who represent a very wide range of African NGOs, from Jubilee South, from the anti-privatization forums in Ghana, in South Africa, in Zambia, in Kenya, are all unilaterally opposed to the Commission for Africa and opposed to opening up Africa to the transnational corporations, which is what these agreements are about. It's certainly not the case that investment in the abstract is a good thing, because what happens then is you have even more inequality. You have the appalling situation where kids in Tanzania have to pay to go to school. Many of them now can't afford to go to school, and that the reason they have to pay to go to school is because the IMF has forced the country to privatize its education system.
John Chaiman, quite very quick response.
Well, I'm just speaking about what I've learned on the ground, talking to ordinary Africans on the street. They're getting jobs, they're getting back to work, and I think it's making a difference that we can see. Investment, more trade is what a lot of them say they need.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. We will continue to follow what is happening in the G8. John Chaiman is the chief Reuters correspondent for Southern Africa. David Miller, professor of sociology, University of Strathclyde, Glasgow, co-editor of the book Arguments Against G8. As we wrap up now with our last story, we turn to the case of jailed Native American leader Leonard Peltier, who was convicted for the deaths of two FBI agents who died during a 75 shootout with the American Indian Movement, known as AIM, at the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in South Dakota. Peltier is serving two life sentences for the fatal shootings, but has always maintained his innocence. He's been in jail now for almost 30 years. He's been serving time at Leavenworth Prison. On Friday, his grandson went to visit him, but found out he had been transferred and put in the hole or solitary confinement at the U.S. Penitentiary in Terre Haute, Indiana. For more on this story, we turn to Leonard Peltier's attorney, Barry Bachrach, who speaks to us now. Can you tell us what is the situation for Leonard Peltier? Has he been moved out of Leavenworth for good?
Yes, he's been moved out of Leavenworth for good. And as you indicated, he was transferred. I didn't even find out that he was transferred until after Cyrus's grandson called me and indicated to me that he'd been moved. And at that point, I got on the phone to make sure that things were okay, and found out when I spoke to Leonard that he had not been given his medications, but just as I called him, he was being given his medications.
And will he be at the Terre Haute prison now for good?
Yeah, as I understand it, yes, and unless we can change his security level and get him into what we believe is a more appropriate setting.
Barry Bachrach, lead attorney for Leonard Peltier. This is Democracy Now! As we wrap up, Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Jeremy Scahill, Maddie Harper, and Nell Geiser. Sharif is our engineer today. DemocracyNow.org is our website. You can go there to sign up for our headlines, transcripts, and video and audio of the show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.